Gun control has been a hotly contested issue in 2018, especially with more and more news of mass shootings. Candidates in Illinois disagree on whether the solution is to make it easier or harder to buy a firearm. Today, we wrap up our series on where the candidates stand by talking about this important issue. Plus, there's a lawsuit dealing with digital copyright that could change how textbooks get used in university classrooms. Publishers and professors disagree over what's quote-unquote fair use. Here's University of Illinois copyright librarian Sarah Benson.
Fair use is a really broad right. You know, I tell my students when they block quote from a book and they don't call the publisher to ask if they can do so, they're exercising their right to fair use. And they've been doing it since they were children. They just didn't know that that's what it was.
But first, the comptroller is in charge of paying the state's bills on time. And that's a tall order given Illinois' financial situation. We'll hear from the three women who are running for this job. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Later in the hour, we'll be wrapping up our series this week on where statewide candidates stand on some important issues. Today, we'll be talking about gun control. But first, our comptroller pays the state's bills using the money it has. If the treasurer is in charge of the state's investments, then the comptroller is in charge of the state's checkbook. And in the upcoming election, there are three candidates: Democratic incumbent Susana Mendoza, Republican Darlene Senger, and Libertarian Claire Ball. Over the next 15 minutes, you'll hear from these three candidates, starting with Susana Mendoza. We're airing these interviews, which we've recorded in advance, in the order candidates appear on the ballot in Champaign County. Mendoza is a Democrat and has been comptroller since 2016 after winning a special election. She's also served as Chicago City Clerk and as a state representative. Comptroller Mendoza, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
So you took office during a pretty difficult time in state government. Illinois was in the middle of a budget impasse that lasted for more than 2 years. And as comptroller, you were responsible for paying the state's bills even when the state hadn't finalized a budget. And I think it's fair to say we're still feeling the effects of that crisis. I wonder how you would help address the continued challenges of the backlog of bills with limited resources if elected to a second term.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you. And I would say that it's been my greatest privilege to get to serve the people of Illinois by managing the state through the worst fiscal crisis in its history. It has, in fact, been pretty tremendous. But I do think that, you know, the record reflects that I've had a very productive term. In the last 2 years, we've passed about 10 years worth of legislation that helps set the stage for the state of Illinois getting on better fiscal footing. As you mentioned, we still have a bill backlog that's significant in scope. It's about $7.5 billion, but that is tremendously better than it was a year ago right now, which at this time, and I would say closer to November, we had hit the peak of $16.7 billion of a bill backlog. So over the last a year later, we're looking at, you know, $7.5 billion, which is much better. We're not out of the woods yet, but as I say, we can start to see some light between the trees. Having said that, though, part of the most important job of being controller right now is continuing to triage the state through this fiscal crisis, because while 7.5 is certainly better than 16.7, it's still bad. And that means there's $7.5 billion worth of bills that have not been paid for services already rendered. And I have to figure out who we need to prioritize so that we can keep businesses open. We don't want them to shut their doors and lay off employees, so that we can keep people who require life-saving services to have access to those services and make sure that we're paying the people who provide those services. So things like nursing home care, hospice care, children and adults with disabilities, these are folks who don't have the resources but need the services, and we need to make sure that we're keeping people healthy and living in a dignified setting. So we also want to make sure that small businesses across Illinois continue to be able to operate and even think about things like expanding or growing their businesses. It's a job of triaging on a day-to-day basis if you're the controller of the state of Illinois, but it's a job that is also incredibly rewarding. And most importantly, throughout that whole triaging of the state's fiscal finances here, we were able to pass monumental transparency reforms in the most toxic of political environments. And I'm very proud to say that every single one of those huge reforms passed with almost unanimous or near unanimous bipartisan support.
Speaking of that toxic political environment, you and Governor Rauner have had a difficult professional relationship, let's put it that way, over the past few years. If Democratic candidate J.B. Pritzker is elected governor, how would you envision the relationship between your office and his?
Well, just for the record, it just hasn't been myself that has had a difficult relationship with Governor Rauner. I mean, he's had a difficult relationship with every single constitutional officer. He has yet to meet with a single one of us. I mean, when was the last time you heard of a governor who refuses to meet with the state's controller or treasurer? He canceled leadership meetings about a week after I took office and was just not communicating with members of his own party. So it's not a personal conflict that I have with the governor. It's just that my job is to tell the truth as to what's happening with the state's finances and to hold people accountable for financial, you know, dysfunction.
Certainly. Fair enough. So how would you do that if if J.B. Pritzker was elected and it was a member of your own party?
So I have a record of standing up to members of my own party as well. I mean, I'd say it'd be interesting if you could go ask Rod Blagojevich, who, of course, is in Colorado right now. I mean, I'll remind your audience that I actually led the impeachment efforts against a governor of my own party. So I have a history of standing up to bad elected leaders, period. You know, I don't suffer bad governors, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. And I've been very clear to JB that, and as I work hard to hopefully get him elected, but at the same time, even in rooms where JB is there, I tell the voters, I said, look, you know, I look forward to working with the next governor because I think you should be able to work with the governor regardless of their party, but I won't work for the next governor. I work for the people of Illinois, and it's my job to hold governors accountable regardless of whether they're Democrats or Republicans, and I'll be happy to do that.
We just have less than a minute left, but I wanted to just ask you, you're running for a second term, but there's also another election in Chicago next year, and I wonder if voters around the state should be concerned that if elected, you might leave the comptroller position to run for mayor of Chicago in 2019.
Well, I just say this. It's obviously I'm very flattered and honored that many people are urging me to run for mayor of Chicago. But as I've told them, I will say to you right now, I am very focused on running for reelection as controller. And I can promise you one thing. As long as Bruce Rauner is governor, the only office that I will be focused on is the office of controller. It is the most important check and balance that the people of Illinois can have towards fiscal mismanagement or just bad governance. And, you know, we've got 13 days to hopefully get ourselves a new governor and get Illinois in a better path. But I'm going to just leave it right there for you, Nyla.
That's Susana Mendoza, who is currently the comptroller for the state of Illinois, running for a second term in office. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. Have a great day.
Next up is Darlene Senger. She previously served as deputy chief of staff to our current governor, Bruce Rauner. She's also served as a state representative and on the Naperville City Council. She's the Republican candidate for comptroller. Darlene Senger, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So the comptroller is in charge of paying the state's bills. Why should voters trust you to handle the state's bills responsibly?
Well, you know, I actually have a background in banking and an MBA in finance, and I've had a lot of experience working in the State House and working with appropriation committees and the rest. So I know, and actually worked as the chief financial officer for an agency, Workers' Compensation Commission. So I know all sides of the story in regards to how budgets are put together and how agencies work. And I know we've got a lot of needs out there in the state. And I'll make sure that we do things fairly and without a political grandstand.
And speaking of the need, we know that Illinois has lots of bills in its backlog. The number is still around $7.5 billion. And of course, we know the state has limited resources to pay all of this. So how would you prioritize what bills to pay?
You know, there's basically, well, one thing, if we had budgets that weren't basically spending more than what we bring in, we wouldn't have such a backlog. But what we need to do is go back to pretty much the concept that Leslie Munger followed when she was the comptroller. You bring in the agencies and the basically the recipients of grants who are requiring the state's money, and you sit down and you kind of prioritize and let them work between themselves on what should be paid first, second, or third. And it's almost like a get the politics out of it, and almost like working as an arbitrator, bring in someone who's neutral on the whole thing to say, hey, you know, this is what we need to do next because this person's going to close their doors.
Politics aside, how would you hold other branches of the state government accountable if they made financial decisions you didn't agree with?
A lot of what I would do is it's not just the accountability, but it's basically the education component of it. I've had a lot of experience in regards to the finances of the state. So much of this, and nothing to say it's a negative type of thing, but a lot of it is just basically bringing individuals up the curve on this is what this means if you do this. For an example, my background is in pension consulting, and I did a lot of work as a state representative to work with individuals who didn't have the financial background and didn't understand actuarial tables and the rest to say, hey, if you guys do this, this is what it's going to cost, this is what it's going to mean.
Every time there's an election, there's a discussion about the amount of money the state could save if it merged the treasurer and comptroller positions. Do you support that idea?
Oh, I do support that idea. It doesn't save a huge amount. You still need to have the functions there. You know, someone needs to be taking care of bill paying. Someone needs to be taking care of the investments. But it's, you know, two constitutional offices that require election. And we're one of three states that have the two. Some states have neither. It's a function under an agency. Between the two agencies, we could save some dollars. Not a lot, but we could save some. Makes sense.
I'm speaking with Darlene Sanger, who is the Republican candidate for comptroller. I wanted to ask you how you would describe your philosophy when it comes to finances.
Here's the philosophy when it comes to finances. I mean, numbers are facts, and we have to get the politics out of the facts that we do have. We're in debt by a huge degree, particularly with the unfunded pension liabilities and with the unfunded retiree health care costs that we're owed. And what we need to do is again, just get to the point to educate individuals to say, this is the burden of debt we have on each taxpayer right now. So the comptroller can be a good resource to go to basically share the figures with individuals and give them the full understanding. Right now, the total burden of debt on each taxpayer is $50,000 per person. And nobody, I think, really gets the gist of what that means. But there's ways to fix it going forward. We just need to get the wherewithal to do it.
So what does that mean? As you've talked about the educating people, that number that you've thrown out, how would you suggest people think about that?
We need to think about that in regards to a lot of that, again, has to do with pensions and retiree costs. I worked actually 3 years across the aisle with a good colleague of mine, Representative Negritz, to basically analyze the pension problem, and we basically created a what I call a toolbox of things that we can do to fix things. So again, it's just getting one up the curve on what this means and how it can be corrected going forward, and it's something we definitely have to do because that's a terrible burden on each and every one of us.
That's Darlene Sanger, who is the Republican candidate for state comptroller. Thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for your questions. Thanks for your time.
And finally, Claire Ball is an accountant from Addison in DuPage County. She's the Libertarian candidate for comptroller. Claire Ball, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So the comptroller's job is to pay the state's bills. Why should voters trust you to handle that responsibly?
Well, it's a big responsibility indeed. The comptroller is responsible not just for cutting checks, but it's also responsible for the financial reporting for the state. The reason why people shouldn't trust that to me is that I've got the financial qualifications that none of the other candidates have. In the 200-year history of Illinois, the office of the comptroller has never been held by an accountant. And to me, an accountant, I'm a CPA, I've got over 12 years experience in the field. When you're talking finances, you want someone qualified. And so that is, you know, reason number one for people to want to look at me.
And when we look at Illinois, we've certainly got a lot of bills in our backlog. The number's still around $7.5 billion.
Yes.
And at the same time, we're obviously dealing with limited resources from the state to pay all of these. How would your office prioritize which bills to pay first?
The bill backlog has been historically around $7 to $8 billion. There should be clear criteria on the comptroller's website that lists out who's going to get paid in what order and why in times of financial crunch. It should always be based on the most immediate need. So those entities that rely the most on government funding, so social service providers, veteran services, followed then by small business owners because business drives jobs and growth. At the bottom of the list would always be those large corporations, entities that can get by for months and months, you know, possibly even years. It's a tough call to make. There is some subjectivity in it. But I think when you've got clearly established criteria, you have something to hold your comptroller accountable to. And if there should be any, if anything gets paid outside of those of that criteria, there should be clear-cut explanation for that.
Every time there's an election, there's a discussion about the amount of money the state could save if it merged the treasurer and comptroller positions. Is that something you would support?
No, I would not support merging the two roles. But that, let me be specific about that. I do not support merging the two roles, the treasurer and the comptroller. I would absolutely support the two of them sharing office space and sharing services. That kind of thing you can do right now. You don't need a constitutional amendment to share a printer. And so I would, as comptroller, be absolutely, you know, looking for in both of our budgets areas where, hey, our offices are doing the same thing here. Let's get some shared services going on. But the reason that I would not advocate for combining the two offices totally is that that eliminates an important check and balance. In the financial world, you should always maintain independence between three areas. That is authorization, record keeping, and custody of assets. Right now, custody of assets falls with the treasurer. He holds the money. And then the record keeping and the authorization falls and sits with the comptroller. And we have had, with all of the fraud and all of the financial malfeasance we've had in the state of Illinois, all of the governors that we've had go to jail, I don't want to see this important check and balance, pushed aside at the for the perception of cost savings.
That's Claire Ball, who is the Libertarian candidate for comptroller. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much.
Support for the 21st comes from University of Illinois Press, hosting the Association of University Press's annual book, jacket, and journal show in the Link Gallery at the School of Art and Design, November 5th through the 16th. University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
For tuning in to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. All week long, we've been discussing some of the biggest issues that are motivating voters this election season. From healthcare to immigration to the economy, we've been finding out where Illinois candidates stand on these issues. And you can find all of those conversations, as well as all of our other political coverage, archived at our website, 21stshow.org. Today, we're wrapping up those conversations by talking about gun control. In the wake of mass shootings like Parkland, Florida, which, if you can believe, was really just 9 months ago, more pressure is being put on politicians to enact gun control legislation. But candidates in Illinois, just like nationally, often disagree on the right solution for this. Joining me now on the line to discuss this is Rick Pearson, a longtime political reporter for the Chicago Tribune. He also hosts the Sunday Spin on WGN Radio. Also joining us from Chicago is Amanda Vinicky, a correspondent for WTTW Chicago Tonight. Amanda, Rick, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Rick, you've been covering politics for quite some time. Before we talk about where the candidates stand on the issue, I wonder what your perspective is on whether you think there's more focus on gun control legislation even this year than there was a couple of years ago.
I think so because, well, one is just because, and perhaps it's through the lens of working in Chicago and the issues of these years of upticks in Chicago gun violence, the fact that where it used to be isolated to certain poor neighborhoods in the city, it's now almost random anywhere in the city, anybody is susceptible to it. And so I do think there's a heightened attention to it. But, you know, through the years, you look at how an issue like gun control really is kind of representative of the diversity of the state and how the optics of guns are so much different in urban and suburban areas compared to when you look at the downstate and the culture of guns downstate.
That's Rick Pearson, who's with us from the Chicago Tribune newsroom. Amanda, I wonder also, just I'm curious your thoughts on that as someone who just transitioned in the past year or two from spending a long time in Springfield to now being based in Chicago. You've really seen the gamut of how different lawmakers, even throughout the state, react to this very differently.
Yeah, this is one of those areas where so many people may be inclined to vote straight party or just to assign themselves as a Republican or a Democrat. But this is one of the many areas in which Illinois, it's really more a regional divide than it is a partisan one, where in Chicago, particularly because of the nature of crime, gangs, violence, what have you in the city, that gun control is far more popular than it is downstate, where people may have guns for self-protection, but by and large for sporting, for hunting. So it certainly is mostly regional. That said, we are clearly in a different time nationally where guns have been used to perpetrate mass shootings in schools, in grocery stores, in places of worship that are not necessarily so easily categorized into city versus rural or anything. So I think that's brought a lot of attention to this, and more so than perhaps anything else, in just trying to really, it's a difficult position for a lot of legislators, I think, as they try to walk that divide because people are scared.
Right. And so that leads us to what's happened in Illinois this year. And in July of this year, Governor Rauner signed a quote-unquote red flag 72-hour waiting period gun control bill. Let's take a listen to him the day he signed that.
It's important that we respect civil liberties, that we respect the Constitution, but that we also do common sense steps to keep residents safe. We've had situations where guns can be kept in the hands of individuals who are mentally unstable or deemed to be dangerous.
Thanks to WBBM for that audio. So as you heard, this bill allows police to take away guns from those who are deemed by courts to pose a threat. And Governor Rauner also, in signing this bill, extended a 72-hour gun purchase waiting period for all firearms. And at the same time, he vetoed a measure with this whole series of actions he did that would add licensing requirements for gun dealer stores. Amanda, do you think that reflects the difference or nuance that Governor Rauner has on these issues? He's kind of straddling this line back and forth between where he stands on this, right?
Yeah, you summed it up right there. He really is straddling his positions on this. He himself is a hunter, but at the same time, he is trying to appeal to the suburban vote in particular, trying to get pockets even of Chicago that helped him to win election 4 years ago. He's in, like so many other places on policy, he's really in a difficult position there. And no matter what, he gets beat up on his position. That said, he definitely does have the support still of groups like the Illinois State Rifle Association, which backed him on some of his measures. I think the ISRA, for example, realizing the political reality at play and perceiving Rauner, at least for those who advocate more gun rights over control, as better than the alternative, namely, now, of course, J.B. Pritzker, but any of the Democratic candidates who were originally even running for governor.
And that brings us to J.B. Pritzker. As Amanda just mentioned, he's the Democrat who's running for governor. He's been pretty vocal about his stances on gun control. Let's take a listen to him. This is actually back in March. This is a WBEZ Chicago Democratic gubernatorial forum.
We have to step up and change the laws in the state of Illinois and make it safer and get rid of the guns that are on the streets. So I want to ban bump stocks. I want to ban assault weapons. I want to ban high-capacity magazines. And I think we got to pass that gun dealer licensing bill and make sure that we have a governor who will sign all that legislation, which I'm doubtful we do today.
That's thanks to WBEZ for that audio. That was back in March. So, Rick, can you remind us about that gun dealer licensing bill, what ended up happening to it? I just mentioned that Governor Rauner vetoed it. What was that bill specifically about?
Well, the bill was the first bill that the governor vetoed was a much stronger bill involving more requirements placed on gun dealers, more requirements placed on the state police to do investigations involving gun dealers. The governor deemed that as too burdensome for business, There was a revised version that actually got bipartisan support that was viewed as less onerous to businesses. And it's kind of interesting that the governor on this issue is taking a kind of a pro-business stance versus even some Republicans who argue that this licensing would be a pro-safety stance. One of the governor's arguments is that federal gun inspectors, they investigate, they license gun dealers in the state. The thing is that most of them haven't been reinspected for 6 years because of the lack of inspectors that exist on the federal level. And the governor has indicated that even though this bill got bipartisan support, that he still views it as too onerous on business. So you got that issue going on. The bill probably, if I'm not even sure Rauner has vetoed the second version, but if and when it happens, that's likely to be overridden regardless of who is governor, just because of how touchy an issue that issue of guns is in the state of Illinois.
Mm. And what else have we heard, Rick, from JB in particular in terms of gun control, different other issues there?
Well, it's kind of interesting that earlier today the governor was on a Southern Illinois radio station and castigated Pritzker as a gun grabber. And one of the things I've been surprised, because I hadn't heard it come up that much, was when Pritzker ran in a failed bid for the Democratic nomination for Congress in the North Shore back in 20 years ago, he was actually a supporter of banning handguns and also was very strong about taxes on gun ammunition. Obviously,
we haven't heard any of that this year, have
we? Exactly. I was going to say, obviously, 20 years later, and you're running statewide and not in a North Shore congressional district, that's changed a lot, and the modifications that Pritzker has made. But nevertheless, still in the wake of these mass shootings, you know, more controls over what's regarded as, you know, semi-automatic weapons. More controls over the size of magazines that guns can use, as well as the bump stocks that can turn a semi-automatic weapon into virtually an automatic weapon.
Right. And we've seen that lawmakers have been pretty reticent when it comes to enacting bump stock legislation. But it's interesting when you look at polling, and I'm thinking about an NPR Ipsos poll from last year. This was after the Las Vegas shooting in which this was used. 82% of respondents to this poll said that bump stocks should be banned. Amanda, have we heard anything from Governor Rauner about that?
He actually says that he, too, supports a ban on bump stocks. It's sort of interesting. This is, to me, one of those areas because it's more been a political volleyball. I mean, this is one of the reasons that when people get frustrated and disgusted by politics, there's good reason to, because, as you noted, there's widespread support. And, in fact, you've seen the General Assembly, both chambers, pass bans on bump stocks, but then just not get it done and across the finish line there. I think, in part, that could be Democrats not wanting to give the governor a victory. It could be a lack of negotiations because Rauner is seen as not being able to work very well with particularly the Democratic leadership. Whatever is there, there's certainly a will, and if there is a will, there could be a way if any of the leadership of the legislature or the governor's office really wanted it to be there. But he does say that he favors and would sign a bump stock ban into law. Maybe that will be, perhaps I could see Democrats saving up a lot of measures, presuming the polls are correct and Pritzker does win, so that he has a lot of, you know, easy victories in his first year in terms of passing the gun control measures that he has promised. And you also do see a ban on bump stocks moving forward, even on the federal level, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's also remember on bump stocks, too, with the governor's support for that, he also ties into that a restoration of the death penalty. He's linked that together, and that there would be a zero certainty in order for the death penalty to be imposed against those who kill law enforcement officers, which raises
that
a whole
The death penalty in that specific reason, in that specific instance only, Rick, just to be clear. Okay.
Yes. Hmm. But
he wants the death penalty for people who. Oh, sorry, Rick. Go ahead.
No, but I mean the mere fact that you raise the issue of restoring the death penalty in Illinois, you know, and that linkage, in essence, that's never going to happen.
Right, given Illinois' history in that realm, right.
So it makes his support for a bump stock ban somewhat tenuous.
Let's move from governor to attorney general. And I just want to, we have about 5 minutes left, but I want to make sure we get to State Senator Kwame Raoul and Erica Harold, who is the Republican candidate. Let's start with Senator Kwame Raoul. Rick, what do we know about, because he was a senator for, he's been a senator for such a long time, we do have a track record of his positions in voting on gun legislation, right, Rick?
Yes, and certainly, you know, he has been one that was certainly involved in the issue of the concealed carry legislation in Illinois. And that was kind of the whole issue of bringing concealed carry to Illinois. It was mandated by the federal courts. The mere fact that Illinois was the last state in the country not to have a concealed carry law is, here again, emblematic of the wide divisions that exist over guns and gun regulation in Illinois. So he was very active in that, and Illinois was able to finally succeed in getting concealed carry. But one of the trade-offs to that also was a limiting provision that prevented municipalities from really enacting stronger gun control measures than what the state allows. And that's created some friction a little bit on the local level. But there's no doubt that he is much more stronger when it comes to gun control than Erica Harold.
Amanda, what can you tell us about the Republican nominee, Erica Harold? I wanted to note an interview that she did with the Daily Herald in July. She said she would defend restrictions on gun ownership enacted by state lawmakers, regardless of what her personal views are on the matter. What has she said about what her personal views are?
Well, she has had that position across the board that her personal views will not matter in terms of what she defends were she to be elected as Attorney General. So sort of an interesting approach there across the board. But when it comes to her personal positions, she likewise said that I believe supports generally a ban on bump stocks, but she said generally it more depends on the scenario in terms of what sort of gun control she would embrace, that you want to look at the arena of violence, is how she's termed it, and then determine how to go after that. And that might not always be gun control. She's also said that there are laws on the books that she believes are not being fully enforced now.
When it comes
and
to,
also in terms of assault weapons, same thing there, that broadly she won't weigh in on assault weapons. And that is sort of difficult to determine what that is. That's a different meaning for perhaps every individual, particularly gun owners who use what may be categorized as such. But she did not, across the board, say that she would ban, quote, assault weapons.
And Rick, I wanted to ask you about how much an attorney general, obviously they don't make laws, they don't vote on laws. So what does attorney general, what power do they have when it comes to gun control?
Well, certainly, obviously, with your own state, and you're basically charged with defending the laws of your state subject to a court challenge, and gun control issues are always being subjected to Second Amendment challenges in the federal court. So that's one job of the attorney general. The second is when attorneys general throughout the United States, normally on partisan lines, go in and weigh in with a front of the court brief on federal cases that might involve their own personal leanings or the leanings of the partisan power that's in control of a state, that they'll weigh in and present front of the court briefs in federal cases that could have ramifications for effects for all of the United States should there be a ruling of the United States Supreme Court.
We just have a minute left, Rick. Can I just ask you really quickly to end, when it comes to gun control, does it matter who the governor is, or are your votes for individual state lawmakers or your federal votes even more important?
Well, you know, it takes a governor to sign a law and or to veto one. So the vote for a governor is very important. At the same time, in order to get legislation to a governor, or prevent legislation from going to a governor, it takes that individual legislator. And, you know, here in the burbs, with socially moderate women being a key factor for this election, you're seeing Republicans in the suburbs sensing concerns about issues about guns and schools and those kinds of things. You're seeing them actually supporting a lot of stiffer gun regulation than would it be the case in the past.
That is Rick Pearson, a longtime political reporter with the Chicago Tribune. You can catch him on Sunday mornings on WGN Radio as host of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank WTTW Chicago Tonight's Amanda Vinicky as well for being with us. Rick, Amanda, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And just a note for our listeners, I am going to be sitting down with Governor Rauner, speaking with him tomorrow. We are going to air that on statewide tomorrow. We'll have that online at 21stshow.org as well if you're not able to catch that program tomorrow around 11 o'clock. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today's college classroom probably looks like nothing you're familiar with if you graduated any time before 2008. Much of the learning is online. Many textbooks are too, but that's been a problem for publishers who still want to make money off what they're printing. And it's at the heart of a lawsuit that's been going on for a decade. This lawsuit's been passed back and forth between lower and higher courts in a ping-pong series of rulings and challenges. 2 weeks ago, this one case we're talking about, Cambridge University Press versus Patton, was sent back to the 11th District Court in Northern Georgia. But it's a case that librarians and publishers are watching closely because it could have big implications for university libraries, teachers, and students. Joining me now in studio to break all of this down is Sarah Benson. She's the copyright librarian for the University of Illinois. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to The 21st.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, Sarah, when we just think about, first of all, what a university classroom looks like nowadays, a lot of it is digital. How often are actual print textbooks being used in college classrooms these days?
Textbooks are still widely being used. However, we used to be in the era of course packs. Course packs were largely printed materials where professors cobbled together different things, some of which were in the library and students were paying for twice, once through their library fee and another through the course pack licensing fee. And now all of this has moved online. So we have what's called e-reserves, or in the case of the University of Illinois, we don't have e-reserves anymore. We have course spaces that have moved online through Blackboard, Coursera, etc. And so faculty members, instead of having course packs, are linking directly, for instance, to the library, to journal articles where students have already paid for that access, right? The university library has licensed access to these things. Where it becomes a problem for publishers is where professors are copying small portions of books that we are not then paying licensing for.
And so that's at the heart of this lawsuit, is how people are using things they don't have a license for.
Yeah. So as Stephen Colbert would say, this is a textbook copyright case, and that is a copyright case about textbooks. He said that about a case, Kurtzong, that went to the Supreme Court. It was a slightly different case. This case is about folks such as myself, professors who are teaching. They would want to use maybe one page, maybe one chapter of a large textbook. They don't want the students to have to buy the entire book. And so what they do is they might decide under their good faith judgment that it is a fair use of the material to not ask for permission and to not seek licensing. And what the publishers are saying is that they want a cut of this market. They have licenses available, and they want the students to pay for the excerpts of the book.
And so how much money are we talking about here? I wonder, when we're thinking about the average cost of a textbook, how much is there such a thing as an average cost of a college textbook? And I know it's probably different when we're talking about graduate versus undergraduate, right?
Textbooks are really expensive, and there have been studies done about this. I don't have the quotations at my ready right now, but I do know that there are students who have to make the decision between paying rent or eating for a month and buying their college textbooks. And often they'll make the choice to eat and live instead of buying their textbooks. And so there's a really big movement going on among librarians and professors called the Open Educational Resources Movement, where we're trying to get professors to make high quality, open access materials available to their students so that the students don't have to pay for access to their textbooks. And they don't have to make that choice between eating and having food security and studying for class.
In fact, I know someone told me once, and I'm not sure how accurate this has been for this school year, but I know someone told me once at the University of Illinois that the most common thing that was stolen were textbooks out of the bookstore.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me a bit, because I think students really are desperate for the information. They really want to learn. And it's really hard to do well in a class if you don't have the textbook, because often, I know as a professor myself, I don't teach to the textbook, right? I don't stand up here and lecture exactly what's in the textbook, because we want to add a value added to our lecture material. And so we expect that our students are reading the textbook and getting that basic background information. And so this case could have broad implications, because if we don't have a broad open access OER system where students can get free resources, and we're having no system of fair use where students can access small snippets, small amounts of textbooks online, then we've got a problem. We're just going to pass along more and more costs to students. And at some point, the students are going to say enough is enough, and they're going to get upset about it and not want to pay these high, high prices.
My guest is Sarah Benson. She's the copyright librarian at the University of Illinois Library. We're talking to her in specific about this one case, Cambridge University Press versus Patton. Sarah, before we get too far into the details, you've been mentioning fair use. Do we have a legal definition of what fair use is, or is that kind of the heart of what this case is about?
Well, fair use is a very broad exception to the rights of copyright owners, and it says that it's not an infringement of copyright to make a fair use of a work without seeking permission or paying licensing first.
Right. We do this. We're a public radio station, so we know that we generally have we're non-commercial, so we know we're not making money off of this. And for example, when it comes to music, we know our sort of general rule of thumb is we could play something that's less than 30 seconds because that's considered fair use.
Well, and that's one of the cruxes of the issue here in this court case, is that fair use is a very flexible test, but it doesn't lend itself to any numerical or quantitative amount. And so one of the things that happened in this case is that originally Georgia State University, who is the party being sued, had a copyright policy in 2008 that said that professors could copy up to 20% of a work for their course without paying permissions. And the publishers got very upset about that and said that's not appropriate. They modified the policy in 2009 to say no more than 10% of a work. And again, the courts have been saying now that's not a bright line rule, right? If you take the heart of a work, even if it's less than 10%, it could not be a fair use. And yet also on the other side of that, you could take up to 30% of a work and it could be a fair use. And it really is case dependent. That is one of the things that the courts have been lobbying back and forth about. The 11th Circuit has been very frustrated with the lower court ruling here because the lower court judge continues to try to apply some sort of quantitative methodology to determining fair use. And the appellate court says, no, it's just not quantitative.
And this has been going on for 10 years?
It started with the lawsuit in 2008, and then the policy, like I said, was amended in 2009, and that's the policy they're challenging, and it's an ongoing challenge. And yes, it's been going on since 2008.
Does the University of Illinois have a policy about this? What should faculty or professors, how do you recommend they think about this issue?
That's a really good question, because we don't have a published guidelines like GSU did. We definitely have a copyright policy that says we're not, as an institution, going to violate copyright, and that we want our users to respect copyright and also to value fair use and things of that sort. But we don't have a hard and fast, you know, you can use 5% of a work or anything like that, because we understand that fair use is very flexible. And really what happens when people have copyright questions is that they are usually, hopefully, referred to me. My role is to empower them to understand how fair use has been applied by the courts and to make the best decision that they can make. Each individual faculty member is empowered to make his or her own fair use determinations.
Of course, the heart of all of this, as we talked about at the beginning, is the cost. We have so many conversations about the cost of college education. Are we having enough conversations about the cost of this particular aspect of education?
I think that we are beginning to have those conversations. I think that's where the open educational resources conversation began, was, you know, from students and faculty and concerned librarians who are worried about students not being able to afford their college experience, not simply through tuition and fees, but through their textbooks. And there actually was just a federal grant program for $5 million towards open access textbooks. And so I think we're getting some traction at the federal level too now, which is a great thing because we really do need to make college textbooks more affordable or free. I actually think they should be free, but that's, you know, easier said than done. We need people to write quality textbooks that are available for free.
I think the whole idea of a digital copyright sounds so vague or abstract. I wonder, as we think about this, how much impact it might have on our day-to-day lives in a way that we might not be aware of.
People are using copyrighted materials every day. One of the common copyright myths is that everything on the internet is copyright free. That's just not true, right? But fair use is a really broad right as well. And in the U.S., we enjoy this right every day. You know, I tell my students when they block quote from a book and they don't call the publisher to ask if they can do so, they're exercising their right to fair use. And they've been doing it since they were children. They just didn't know that that's what it was. And when we tweet something on Twitter and we pin something on Pinterest, we're often exercising our right to fair use. Not to mention the fact that we own our tweets. That's my content. Those are my expressions and I own them.
Do you think it's important for us to understand that? Do you think we do understand that?
I think there's a lot that we don't understand. And one of the research projects that I'm engaged in right now involves terms of service and folks who are scraping the internet and potentially violating terms of service and doing data analysis on all of this stuff. The issue there is that some researchers are afraid they're going to get sued for the anti-hacking law under federal law, and that raises the penalty of felonies. I'm concerned for them, too, and there's actually a lawsuit going on, and a professor here at University of Illinois is a part of that suit. They actually just had a motion to dismiss, and I read the district court decision in that case, and the district court said, you know, yeah, there is a potential here for a lawsuit, and we're going to allow this case to continue. So it's ongoing.
So when it comes to personal individuals and our knowledge of copyright, what do you think, especially when we're thinking about this current age of technology and social media, what do you think people should keep in mind?
I think that they should keep in mind that they own a lot of information and they share a lot of information. And so we should think about how we want others to treat our information when we use theirs, right? And also, I think there's a lot of information that we want to share. When I put things on Facebook, I'm not trying to keep them really close, right? And on Twitter, for instance, Twitter is very open, at least under my page. I don't have any lockdown privacy notices there. And so people can also learn about open access. They can learn about Creative Commons licensing. I put a Creative Commons license, for instance, on my syllabi because those traditionally faculty members are very friendly about sharing that. I do own my syllabus. It's my own independent creation, but I want people to feel free to steal my syllabus. I want knowledge to live on. I want other people to learn from what I do. I put Creative Commons on as many things as I can because I really want other people to use my resources. So when I create a library guide, other people are free to use it because I don't want to lock down my ideas and my contribution to copyright knowledge.
That's Sarah Benson. She's the copyright librarian at the University of Illinois, talking to us about all of these issues as we think about this new digital age. Sarah, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's all the time we have for today. Tuesday's Election Day. If you haven't registered to vote yet, you can still do it now. Just be prepared to vote when you go register, or you can even register on Election Day. Tomorrow, I'll be interviewing Governor Bruce Rauner about his campaign for a second term in office. We'll air that interview on our partner program statewide during the 11 a.m. hour for stations that carry it. And we'll, of course, have it up online later in the day as well. Check our social channels, Facebook and Twitter. We'll share the links there. If you've missed any of our candidate interviews this past week, we're also putting together a podcast compiling all of what the candidates we interviewed had to say. A reminder, it includes interviews with candidates on the ballot for governor, as well as candidates for attorney general, treasurer, and comptroller. And we've taken the time to edit out the best parts of all of those interviews I did. So if you want to spend 15 minutes with us, you can get a sense of what these candidates stand for before you head to the voting booth. That 15-minute special podcast will be up tomorrow after our interview with Governor Rauner. Again, check our social channels for when we release it, as well as wherever you get your podcast feed. If you subscribe to the 21st, it will come up automatically, and you can find that special podcast on our website, 21stshow.org. Right at the top of the page is a link to all of our election coverage. Finally, on election night, Brian Mackey and I will be anchoring live coverage as the results come in across the state. So stay tuned to this NPR station for that. We will be starting special coverage during the 7 p.m. hour on Tuesday after the polls close. Our Twitter handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. On our Facebook page, if you search for the 21st to like us, you can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on there. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. We love hearing from our listeners, especially when you all suggest segments. We do look at those emails, and sometimes they end up on air, so shoot us a line. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.